This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
So that was actually 2 minutes of silence that was recorded by the BBC and broadcast in 1938. The first recognized 2 minutes of silence on a national basis was in commemoration of the Armistice Day, and it began in 1919. And these 2 minutes of silence proved, in fact, so popular that the BBC began lobbying to record it, and 10 years later they started doing so. And people listened to these broadcasts for decades after, and it proved enormously powerful both in its live enactment throughout England and eventually through a larger part of Europe, but also just people in their own homes listening to these 2 minutes of silence. So we're going to screen Matz's fantastic film and then go back a little bit into why those 2 minutes might have had the resonance that they seem to.
Okay, Sina. Is the beamer on? It's black on the screen, so maybe it's black there. Maybe we turn off the light. Maybe if you turn off the light, we will. Okay. Yeah, it's on. No, it's not on. It is on. Thank you.
Mats, I've seen this film so many times at this point, and I have to say, this is really the case of a film where I glimpse and learn something new every time. Mm. When we watch the list at the end of the different events that are being memorialized, it reminds us of the ways in which, on some level, this is a cataloging of catastrophe. But the film doesn't feel like that at all. And I wonder if you could say something about the genesis of it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea's been there for quite some time, actually. But then, at some point, I think around 2013, probably after the Lampedusa event where all the migrants died, there was sort of an increase of these medialized and televised moments of silence. And I started to think that it would be interesting to actually investigate if there was a body of these events. Since I never worked with archival material before, it was very interesting to dig into this Swedish television archive. And a friend of mine let me into the archive. And so I started to gather all this amount of clips. And I saw that there was a possible chance of actually doing something with it. But then it was a long process, because the difference between working with archival material and found footage is that these news material you have to buy. So we needed to sort of present it for Swedish television to find someone who would finance the film. And believe it or not, by a chance, there was a new film commissioning editor. The classical one, she was on maternal leave. So this new woman, she had the first her first meeting. I came up with this idea. She said, like, okay, let's do it. So then we embarked on the process of collecting all the material and trying to build this structure.
Can you say anything about what was guiding the process of coming up with the rhythm of the film? I mean, there's clearly the trajectory in a very simple sense of mm-hmm. the beginning to the moment and the release from it. But it's so subtly orchestrated, and the repetitions within certain cultures and the singularities seem so considered.
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to the editor, Dino Jungsäter. He's a brilliant film editor, and he got the material, and we had this sort of a vision idea. So actually, he worked for 2 weeks, presented some different versions, and at the start, we actually thought we would need to include graphics to sort of present which events you were looking at. But after a while, we realized it's so much stronger to just have it without any words or anything, and just add these credits and captions in the end.
What was the thinking with respect to the sound design, too, which I became more aware of?
Interesting problem you're facing when you're going to sound design silence. And when I was doing research, I came across your book, In Pursuit of Silence, and it was really interesting to read that, and I was very inspired by the book and how you look upon silence and how you start thinking about silence, which, of course, isn't there. There's always a sound in the background. So the challenge was to use the existing sound but also add something that would make it natural. But if you listen carefully, there is actually some music there. There is a Mahler Fifth Symphony, which is slowed down, I think, 5 times.
That's
to get some kind of, you need a sort of emotional backdrop.
It seems to stitch it very well also.
Yeah. I don't know. I think so. Because we tried it without any music in the background. It just became very flat.
You know, one thing, mentioning something that had struck me in early on in my research, which obviously seems so embedded in this work, is really the etymology of the English word for silence, which is somewhat disputed. There's not a clear etymology, which is surprising because it's been looked at extensively. But it does seem that the two roots that are certainly there is there's one Gothic verb, anasalon, which means the wind dying down, and then there's a Latin word, desinere, which means to stop. So I became fascinated with the idea that both, at least, of these wellsprings of the term have to do with an interruption of motion and an interruption of active impressing of the self or of any form of action upon the world.
Yeah, and this is also so striking as an artist, and we work a lot with sculpture, these performances or collective actions become sort of a monument also of sorrow in the aspect that they really halt, the commotion stops, nothing goes on.
I think from that, although we talked about coming to this later, I mean, I liked very much, and maybe you could say a little bit about the ways that the figures in these moments began to seem to you sculptural.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of different clips which are more specific than others. And I would bring this up again, which is from Erbil in Iraq, where actually the idea of having a moment of silence is, I think, Saddam Hussein ordered this moment of silence, and the Kurdish population had to stand still. And if they wouldn't stand still, I guess they would be executed. And in the end of the clip, you also see the soldiers that are sort of extremely nervous, trying to just stand still, trying to keep this sort of... I mean, this is very different from the other clips, but it has that quality, that sculpture quality. Otherwise, I think the whole idea of gathering these groups of people, for me, was one of the main ideas why we did the film, was that trying to show in a more fragmented situation we are now than a couple of years ago, it seems that the only activity that sort of brings people together, no matter what background in terms of race or religion, is this moment of silence.
Right, and we'd spoken a little bit about the way that within Quakerism, certainly part of the idea of the silence in the Quaker ceremony was the inclusiveness of it, that because this moment of waiting for God to come to the congregants didn't impose a particular doctrinal vision of what God's presence would be constituted in and of.
That was also very much an individual experience. I mean, this I also find it so interesting that you bring this individual experience, you so to speak, step out of yourself for a little moment and become a stand-in for the dead, as you also write in your text. But it's a communal, it's a community thing. I was thinking one clip that we found while doing our research, which is quite different from the other clips, is this Swedish farmer which makes his own sort of moment of silence. I don't know.
We should see that. I think, because that is at the other antipode from...
Yeah, it sort of relates to the Quaker idea of going, I mean, going into your own silent mode. And the question with this clip is how... It's also about mediation. I mean, if you do your own silent minute, why is this caught on film in the first place?
Vår grundade mening är P1, 15 och 25.
Och så ska fröken Ur upplysa om tiden.
12, 59 och 50.
Det blir rapport från Smålands landsbygd stod stilla en minut idag. Klockan 13 stängde Thomas Nilsson utanför Braås av motorn i traktorn. En tyst minut för att hedra de båda kollegorna som mördats i sina hem. En minut också till eftertanke för en landsbygd utan våld.
Det känns tungt. Och jag känner sorg över det som har hänt förstås. Och samtidigt känner jag en vrede också över det som har hänt. Det måste jag säga. Det är så onödigt egentligen.
En tyst minut. Jag tror att en sån manifestation har någon effekt mot våldet.
Både ja och nej. Det är ju en handling som visar att vi bryr oss. Och att vi inte låter det passera liksom bara utan att göra någonting åt det. Sen för brottet som sådant har ju redan skett. Så på det viset har det ju ingen betydelse. Va? Men det kanske känns bra också för de som står honom nära. Kan jag tänka mig.
That's certainly at the other antipode from where the moment of silence began, and there is something a little bit absurd about it. But I don't know whether the absurdity is because it's being televised, and because the idea of you making this private act has already become, in fact, the property of however many millions of people were watching that news broadcast. Mm. It also is a very compressed minute of silence,
yeah.
As you pointed out.
Yeah, it's not
for
really
10 seconds. Not even. And I love the question about whether, do you think this will affect the violence? Mm. Yes and no.
Yeah.
You know, but going back to the beginning and this moment of the armistice, at a certain point, the BBC... A BBC representative was asked why he thought it was that people took something from this broadcast. And his remark was that the impressiveness was always going to be intensified by the fact that the silence is not a dead silence. For Big Ben strikes the hour, and then the bickering of sparrows, the crisp rustle of falling leaves, the creasing of pigeon wings as they take flight, uneasy at this strange hush, contrast with the traffic din of London some minutes before. The role of the BBC, he concluded, was to allow the silence to be heard for what it really was, a solvent which destroys personality and gives us leave to be great and universal. And I love the expansiveness of the embrace of that, which is so different than this single act, and indicates the way that there really is, and it comes out in your film over and over, a taxonomy of different sorts of moments of silence. I mean, we maybe impulsively lump them all together, but there is something obviously happening in that original moment that's very commemorative, right? And it's not about the anger that the farmer says is part of what he's doing here.
No, it's about showing solidarity. Basically.
Showing solidarity, yeah. and having that. I love that idea that in showing solidarity, you yourself acquire the greatness of the communal embodiment of this loss. There seems to be maybe a bit of a movement where that sort of memorialization is perhaps a little less. It's not absent, but maybe it's a little bit less of what happens today. I mean,
Well, we see an increasingly mediation of these moments of silence and. I would have like the contrapoint to this clip would be after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris earlier this year,
there were over 4 million people who participated in kind of national moments of silence, or national minute of silence, as we call it. In Europe, it's a minute of silence. And I just have this clip. I don't know, maybe we could look at it. It's from a school outside Paris. It's a school in the 16th arrondissement, which is a quite nice neighborhood. And there was questions during these moments of silence around Paris, specifically in some areas where which are heavily segregated, that there were groups of predominantly Muslim students who didn't want to participate because they said, we're not, je ne suis pas Charlie. And I mean, it sometimes these events also highlights the difference between people, and that's in this case, which is also contradictory. And this clip, I mean, it's also contradictory what is going to happen after they finish this moment of silence. So my question would be, can you treat this ritual in any way? I mean, now we see like different ways of sort of twisting and turning this ritual.
Well, this is, I mean, also...
It's a sort of performance that you were managing to keep quiet for 1 minute. So you have to like cheer and shout.
No, I think it's a remarkable clip. And of course, you know, as you said, this was probably the largest observance of moments of silence in history. And it was for 12 people, correct?
Yeah.
And in the World War, the scale is so dramatically different. Mm. And the question is not only what is something being mourned in this at all, or is in fact the silence in some way taking the role of refusing to be silenced? And you're right that there is a kind of self-congratulatory moment, which is perhaps not completely frivolous at the end with the students. I mean, one thing, I had one remarkable experience when I was researching for my book, because part of what, I don't think that this is completely a separate issue, but the increasingly rare commodification of silence, the increasing rarity and commodification of it. And when I was researching, I became only more aware of the class divide that determines access to silence in so many cases. And this is particularly true in cities, or particularly perhaps dangerous in large urban environments where you have often the underprivileged populations who are already the most at risk for so many things, are also the groups that have the least capacity to put their children in situations where there is any quiet at all, which of course affects learning and affects attention and all sorts of things. And I had one experience where I knew a teacher in a very tough part of Brooklyn. A few still exist. And he, you know, this is an enormous guy. He's 6'7", I think, or something. And he's very charismatic and an athlete. And he taught in this school, and he taught mathematics. And he told me that he couldn't get his students to be silent for a single minute. And I simply didn't believe him. So I began going to the school, and watching him trying to do this, and seeing how... These were high school students. They weren't little kids. They were sophomores. And seeing how they simply couldn't hold themselves in for that long. And after going back and forth a few times, I said to him, I thought, all right, well, what might be the common experiences of silence upon which some greater appreciation of this state might be built, might be nurtured. So I asked him to ask the class to talk about, for each one of the students, to think about a moment of silence that had been particularly important in their lives. And then we were going to all gather together in the following week, and they were going to reveal to me their different experiences. And I remember sort of anticipating this eagerly and thinking I was going to learn about all these extraordinary moments that they'd had with themselves, etc., where they'd actually found this silence that wasn't available in their schools, in their stores, in their streets, or in their homes as a regular thing. And I was with a circle of about 12 kids, and the first one said, "I remember when my father hit my mother, I didn't want to talk for a week." Second kid says, "I remember when my brother was shot, nobody in my family talked for a week." And every one of these situations was a situation where silence was associated with being silenced and with an extraordinary sense of anguish. And I realized that there was just no silence to be had in these communities, and that this had all sorts of implications for the effort to, you know, say, turn down boomboxes or whatever, to try to control the noise that these kids made, because what value could they place upon something that they hadn't been given at all by their society? And I think now we see in these moments of silence a real an erosion of certainty, maybe, about how to behave within them. I mean, maybe this is a moment to show the clip that you have of Kim Kardashian and this.
Yeah, might be a good idea, actually. No, but I was thinking what you said about sonic pollution and what it does specifically with our kids. It also produces this fear of silence, because me myself experience a lot of tinnitus when it comes to, like, when you enter a silent space, for instance, there's always this ringing backdrop, which also relates to kind of sadness in a sense, or mm-hmm. depression. I mean, tinnitus can also be, of course, created by stress. So. And for me, the film deals a little bit with that as well, sort of a tinnitus of sorrow. That when it comes to the Kardashians, I don't know if they have those thoughts, actually. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. I hope I can keep it running a little while longer.
Kim K and her sisters are being slammed for tweeting or texting or something during the moment of silence for Ferguson at the VMAs. All right, it has not been confirmed that this could have been a delay in videotape, but here's what all the eyewitnesses at the VMAs are saying. Kim and Kendall and Kylie Jenner were fiddling on their phones during a moment of silence held as a tribute to the conflict in Ferguson. Angry fans are blasting the girls for not paying attention during the moment of reflection. The emotional tribute was led by rapper Common, who had asked for the audience's undivided attention while they honored Michael Brown, who died after being shot by police in Missouri earlier this month. One Twitter user writes, "Let's not pretend we're shocked that the Kardashian girls were texting during a moment of silence for Ferguson at the VMAs." Another writes, "I would pay top dollar to see Kim Kardashian point out Ferguson on a map." Meanwhile, not a peep from the girls on social media now, when it really matters. They need to confirm or deny it. Hey everyone, thanks for watching Holly Scoop, and be sure to stick with us all the time for all the latest.
I think it's a remarkable clip, in part because everyone just looks so post-human.
And it's not only a kind of audio pollution, it's also visual pollution.
Right.
I don't see anyone texting here, but if there was anyone texting here during this event, it has all been recorded. And I will personally edit an equally visually contaminated jingle and post on social network.
Well, I told you this this anecdote that I had happened to me exactly at this time last year, where I was moderating a panel about on the question of whether or not it was still possible to have the public intellectual in the space with live people. And I had some very distinguished people were the panelists. A Hungarian dissident in his 80s, and there was Anne Pasternak, the head of Creative Time, and there was Deborah Eisenberg, who's a remarkable fiction writer. And we were having this discussion. It was in the umbrella of the Penn World Voices Festival. And in the front row, there was someone texting, as we're talking about the possibility of having a concentrated event with people live, there was someone texting furiously away. And this was going on and going on. And finally, I just couldn't take it, so I sort of said, and meanwhile, we're having this conversation, and this gentleman in the front row is at this very moment breaking this, you know, breaking the little, whatever kind of little communal space we've created, and he's using his phone and he's texting. And what was surprising to me was then at that point, people in the back of the room began shouting at me, saying, how do you know he's not tweeting? What are you doing trying to interrupt him? And I just thought at that moment that the whole event was really beyond my grasp. Because I wasn't sure where it was happening anymore. I mean, if it really wasn't happening in the room, there was a legitimate point. But if we've really lost the ability to be in that space together, that also seems to me very terrifying.
So the moment of silence then is also a way of being together and having an awkward silence without anyone feeling awkward about it. But it's all, I mean, I was thinking of that when I've seen this film together with other people. It's also a weird experience. I don't know if you experienced that, but I had the feeling, maybe because I'm a bit tense while watching it together with other people, is that since it's silent, you become extremely aware of how other people are reacting during the actual screening of it. So it becomes sort of a meta event, because sitting together watching a film is also a situation where we silent together.
Except, of course, as you show in the very first clip, you've inscribed also this larger problem. We should look at that once more.
Should we look at that? We can look at it again.
I was amazed watching that, realizing it's like the technology itself is angry that people are trying to be quiet. It can't take it, and these furious shutters become their own cacophonic assault.
Yeah, we didn't know if we could keep it in the film, because at first point it seems so exaggerated, just too much. I mean, what are people going to think? Is that actually happening? But it sort of sounds realistic anyway, because you have the camera there, and it's Obama and Michelle, so of course you're going to, you know, gain a lot of camera attention.
You know, going back actually to the very beginning of the moment of silence, the inspiration for it came from a man who'd been high commissioner in South Africa during the First World War. And there had been 3 minutes of silence and reflection every single day of the war. And that's what he brought back to England when he was making the case for why 2 minutes of silence should be observed for Armistice Day. And it seems that, you know, we have this convergence of problems where we have both silence itself as a diminishing phenomenon, and we sort of want 2 minutes of silence in commemoration of silence itself, I think, at this point. But we, on top of this, we also have a confluence of disaster that, at least in the ways that we are made aware of it by the media, puts a new kind of pressure on the moments of silence. I mean, what would happen if we were to actually try to commemorate every disaster at this point that we become aware of?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question, because I remember I was in Amsterdam and screened the film in November last year, and there was someone in the audience who had a question regarding, you know, the instrumentality of using this moment of silence as a sort of, you know, imposed action from the government telling people to be silent, because they had just experienced this enormous tragedy of the plane that got shot down over Ukraine. So they had like 150 or something Dutch people coming back in coffins And sometimes it was like 5 a day and or 4 a day. And the state said that there should be a moment of silence for every coffin that comes home. So, I mean, this repetitive idea of using the moment of silence became almost like a trauma that was repeated over and over again. So, I mean, I guess it's difficult to know the exact right level. On a yearly basis, we see it like in the film we have, the Armistice Day is the first, and then I think it was in Israel who started to use it for the Holocaust Day, have it every year, and also in Poland they have something called the Wee Hour. And now we have September 11. With this, I don't know when they started broadcasting it from the White House. Was it immediately after?
I don't know the answer.
I don't know either. So the question is how large the catastrophe have to be in order to create a yearly recurring moment of silence.
Right, and obviously, beginning with the First World War, there had to be catastrophe on a certain scale before people came up with the thought. Right, I mean, the First World War as a man-made disaster.
Maybe I actually have the clip. The first moment of silence, which were broadcasted in 1919, but without sound. I mean, it was a silent film. That you have, you get an idea of the amount of people who gathered for this event. It's still a huge event. I mean, every 11th of November at 11 o'clock. I don't know if anyone here is from England. Yeah, this hat gesture is also something that we took as a starting point and end point in the film. Because it seems like there's a protection for the individual with the hat.
This idea of losing that protection.
Yeah, so you take it off in order to, you know, open yourself up for something larger, something bigger.
I mean, I remember the first time that I was in Jerusalem for a Holocaust Remembrance Day, 2 minutes of silence, and I'd been outside, and I really had I was not anticipating the event in any way. I wasn't coming to it with any desire to experience the solidarity or to experience what happened, and I was absolutely caught off guard. To be in a crowd and watch people almost freeze in their steps and people step from their cars and doors hanging open, and to watch the traffic lights blinking above you without any motion, I could understand and felt with everyone the enormity of loss. You feel sucked into that space when it's completely fully observed in that way, I think it's just an overwhelming thing. And it would certainly be a terrible loss if we devalued it either because we just forgot what silence was or because we no longer had the ability to stop mediating moments to an extent that this silence itself became degraded within the event. I mean, I think of almost as the bookend to this image of the first anniversary of the armistice, if you can say something about the football and sort of what has happened with that, because...
For me, like, the football is one of the more classic moments of silence because it's televised, and the football game is all about sound and sharing and, you know, being together, and to have this moment of silence becomes so extremely powerful when it comes to, I don't know how to play this. What happened to the play game? To watch it that way. I don't know what happened to PowerPoint. I don't know PowerPoint. No, but what I want to come to is, like, now there's a new idea with this moment of silence in the football circumstance, that they introduce something called a minute of applause, which is totally the other way around. And there's this amazing, I mean, I just found this footage on the internet. It's commemorating a very famous football player and a coach, a former national coach of the English team, with a minute of applause.
And the marker of respect to the late great Robbie Robson, former manager of Newcastle United in England.
Researching the effects of silence, one thing I was looking into was hearing, and speaking with people who are looking at hearing on a molecular basis and talking about why it is that the ear is such an extraordinary amplifier, which, as those of you who know something about it may know, the ear in fact amplifies a sound that's in space hundreds of times. And I was asking why it was necessary to do this, and the scientist that I was speaking to said, well, of course, in nature, there are very few loud noises. You know, you have the occasional thunderstorm, and you have a volcano, and you have an earthquake, you have these, and then you have the moment of real, in mating season, you might have the roar, the different kinds of vocalizations that are there to assert masculine authority. But this is in a very contracted period, and most of the time, for most animals, and certainly for humans, when what became the human ear was evolving, hearing is an early warning system, and we want to be listening to the smallest possible noise. It's why you actually can hear a pin drop in an even relatively quiet room. When you think about how little energy is being released by that pin, it's remarkable. But hearing is actually how our species, and all those species that aren't giant and filled with lots of claws and teeth, manage to survive. And it's almost as though our hearing is the one instance of a sense that has the evolutionary reason for its acuity has flipped, and it's almost we don't want to be able to hear as much as we can now, and we seem more and more dependent on filling every kind of space with as much acoustical, visual, soon olfactory stimulation as possible. And it's so, it makes these moments of silence. I mean, can you have them really 2 minutes of silence with as much coverage of the minutes of silence as seems now to those moments attract?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
It's something.
What do you think? If you prognosticize, what will the development be? I mean, it's interesting also with the length that we can stand a minute, 3 minutes, but longer. I know the footage from Central Park in 1980 when Yoko Ono sent out a message that people should gather to commemorate the death of John Lennon. She said it should be quiet for 10 minutes. And people were quiet for 10 minutes together, which is quite an
amazing
sort of freeze mob. I mean, I don't know what happened to the freeze mobs. They disappeared. I thought that was quite an interesting parallel sort of public performance thing.
You should say a little bit more about what those were.
No, the freeze mobs were, I mean, I think everyone's familiar with that. There was one very, very famous here at the Grand Central Station where people, it's also like a first communal product, a positive product of the social media, that people connected and sent out messages, let's meet in this specific hour and minute, we all just freeze and be quiet. So we create this sort of public sculpture or performance. And this spread all over the world. And Japan is like an amazing freeze mob performance, but it sort of disappeared. So maybe we can bring them back in connection. I don't know.
Well, it's something, you know, anthropologists have looked also, of course, at animals. And there are instances with wild elephants, for example, when a member of a herd dies, they will sometimes gather and stand in silence around this. Horses, there have been recorded observations of horses doing something similar. So it's a very, very deep need. And to me, I feel watching this and looking at the Hebdo images, I mean, I feel there's a real tension between commemoration and between refusal of some perceived imperilment of a right. Those seem to be coming at the possibilities of silence from very different perspectives. Maybe almost mutually exclusive ones. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it's so taboo to break a silence like in an event like this. If someone would just start screaming, I mean, that would be, you know, very strange. I mean, we have this sort of, I don't know, automatic mute button in certain specific events and specific, I mean, the moments of silence or in grief. I mean, we just turn silent, I think, pure by nature, and try to look inwards. But as with the kids, Charlie Hebdo, it's difficult. It's getting more and more increasingly difficult. So we have to find ways of training it, maybe. I'm trying to train it. And while doing this film, it's really changed my way of trying to find some sort of silent. And I actually went for a week to my summer house in Gotland, reading your book, Being Silent, was extremely difficult. And I know someone here has also been part of this longer silent retreats. You also been?
I did some, but not the kind of length of your friend. But yeah,
can you recommend it? Is it good?
I definitely can. I mean, I think, you know, I think what people take from them. I'm quiet. I mean, because I'm writing, I'm quiet a fair amount of time, and yet there is something different about actually making that decision that there will be no speech.
Maybe we should just pronounce a national week of silence for all the horrors.
Well, as you said, I mean, at one point we could be silenced the rest of our lives if we were in any way commemorating what happened. But you know, I want to pick up what you said about cultivation, because in a positive way, one of the only positive things that I've found is that with all of the pressure, particularly for young people, on having any experience of silence, there was a woman I spoke with who works with kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, and she was involved with a project where she would take groups of kids out to the wilderness, really out far in the countryside, and take them on silent walks. And she said that unbelievably quickly, if she imposed a rule of silence in nature, even these kids who came from backgrounds where they had so little silence experience and virtually none that was positive, that they could learn it. And not only that, but that it didn't seem oppressive. Mm. I mean, we have also, as you spoke about fear, we have these associations of silence with piety and with, I think, with an overly, sometimes an overly sacral sensibility. But it can mean many different things. And even for the people observing these minutes of silence, I'm sure their emotions are not monotone. Emotions are dramatic sometimes. Mm. It's not dull. There's a set of associations that I think we can educate people to think about differently, and one hopes something like your film can play a part in that.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe we can take some questions. Yes?
Yeah, if there's any questions.
Mike, let me bring it over.
Thanks, you guys. I guess to George's last point about piety, I was going to say that you both know this, but I teach a class on sound, and George has been a speaker in this class, and I've screened Matz's film in this class, and I haven't told you this, actually, but it was really interesting when I screened it, because everybody went into moment of silence mode watching it. And I found that very interesting. There was sort of a moment when the film ended where everybody, you know, exhaled and relaxed and kind of went back to normal. And I just wonder, in the screenings that you've had of this film, if people tend to behave that way. It's just funny how this film sort of can induce a kind of reverent, you know, respect paying. I mean, it's almost like the film becomes a kind of monument, too. I just wonder if that happens normally.
It's difficult to say. I mean, as I am always so tense while watching the film together with other people, to have some sort of feeling of what people think. But as you say, I think it's a possible way of using the film as a way of also meditating on your own losses. Or I think it's unavoidable to associate to things that happen in your own life. So hopefully. What I experienced was a heightened type of concentration. In a heightened way that people were suddenly like, oops, I have to, you know, focus here because something is going on. I can't just lay back and have my popcorns. You know, you have to, the silence introducing a sort of heightened awareness, I would say.
That's interesting. So it almost becomes meditation.
Yeah, it was actually, I had an interesting screening in Copenhagen where there was the guy who was programming this festival. He had this idea to invite a Buddhist meditation expert to put people for 10 minutes. We were meditating in total quietness before watching the film to get down in a certain mood. And I realized when I was sitting there and he was like, you know, starting this meditation, my heart was just like dum 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 because we were running around this festival trying to get there. So you just realize, God, I'm so stressed. You know? But then after 10 minutes, you were down at a certain level. So that was an interesting experience, I would say.
In your film, you have footage from all over the world, from different cultures and different religions. And I wonder if you have come to any conclusions what sound represent, because in the film what's very emotional is that you have this feeling that the conclusion is that we are all the same, independently of culture, religion, etc. And I wonder what do you think about this?
I mean, that's one of the images that we, of course, want to present, but it was more difficult. I mean, this is a European, a Western tradition, starting with Armistice Day, but it's spreading, so I think some of these events, one of the few we found from Africa was after the attack by Al-Shabaab in Kenya. So I think that the ritual is being picked up also. And the weirdest one absolutely was after Fukushima, where you have the rescue team standing there. And there were some images we didn't bring in, which were also the actual staff from the nuclear power plant, who was sort of responsible for the whole catastrophe, were standing. But then it was more like shame, like, you know, they were standing there in shame
because they generated that. So that kind of jumped out. But we wanted to find a diverse image as possible. I don't know if that's a good answer to your question. But
were there any cultures that you found in the West that really that didn't at this point that where you didn't find any moments of silence? Were there any?
Actually, I thought I would find something in Russia. There were some, but there was one really interesting with Vladimir Putin, which was probably the shortest moment of silence. He didn't have, you know, he was up for 5 seconds and then down again. So it was so absurd, so it didn't fit in. Mm-hmm. It could have actually made it for the bonus material. No, I can't say that there were in a specific region that we couldn't find anything. I think we have a quite good coverage.
Yeah.
First, thanks, George, for your book. And thanks, Mats, for your film. They're both very compelling. I just wanted to reflect from the perspective of having spent a lot of time in religious world in the past few years, one of the ways in which the moment of silence and the montage of moments of silence reaches me or strikes me is, first of all, for its universality and for its ability to encompass very diverse and very generally dispersed groups. But second of all, for its lack of a liturgical frame, because you do encounter pockets of silence in liturgy, but they carry certain, let's say, a more coherent frame often for a particular kind of intentionality. And I'm not saying this authoritatively. You can feel free to obviously disagree with that. But the question that I wanted to ask was reflecting on the mediation and on the representation of it, and how it's maybe peculiarly accessible and also maybe susceptible to documentation and representation, and how in some cases the representation almost comes to substitute for a metaphysical frame, as really struck me with the farmer, in that it was, he couldn't quite put his finger on a metaphysical purpose to what he was doing, but it may have showed the people that, that he felt for them. But if you were to see something like this that was a montage of prayer, I think that it would strike us as invasive, and there would be some borders that would be crossed or something that you wouldn't. There's something less conducive in liturgical context representation. And just wondering what you might think about that.
Well, I mean, when we did this, it was part of these mediated clips that you see on. I mean, it's all collected from news media. I mean, if you would have gone out to make your own film with your own camera, it would have, of course, looked completely different. So the things that you sort of jump from when you see these clips, that a lot of them have a certain weird absurdity to it, how they're sort of shot and mediated. And I don't know if you would do a similar thing with prayer. I don't know. I mean, that's sort of something which is so personalized and also commonly occurring. So yeah, but that's an interesting idea. Must have been done films like that, though. I guess.
I mean, it would feel, I tend to think, it would feel more anthropological if you were looking at liturgical expressions, because they're so much more culturally and theologically particular. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this still hasn't, you feel the diversity without feeling the exclusivity of the observance, I think.
Mm. Yes. If you look into headphones with noise suppression,
I certainly did. I don't know what you know about
your book and your
book. Yeah, in my life and in my book.
Manufacturing.
I mean, it's very hard to block out speech, right? I mean, they work for certain kinds of constant bands of noise, but it's still a long way from effective.
I mean, there were artists trying to do these big installations with like creating corridors of silence. It just didn't work. The technology is not there yet. Richard, you want to ask something?
The First World War armistice was the first governmental organized version of silence. But are there, in doing your research, were there prior instances of, maybe not by a government entity, but large scale moments of silence that were not free of things like, obviously at a funeral or something where a group of people might be gathered around a grave, but in other instances, is there any early examples of this that go back prior to the media age? Because it seems like it starts with the media age.
I looked very hard, and it's an interesting question. And one of the things that was intriguing to me is there are many reports, for example, of moments of silence immediately after the Titanic sank. But in fact, this didn't occur. Or it didn't occur as an orchestrated event. And in the specific instances that were referred to, I was able to discover that it was projected onto scenes of mourning that in fact had nothing to do with silence. The only earlier observance of any sort I found is a very strange, that I found written about anywhere, was the transition between Lent and Mardi Gras. In certain places, there would be this pause, a real beat, a communal beat, before the outpouring. It's not this, but it had some kind of liminal space significance in these two opposite kinds of expressions of faith, where the silence seemed to both bridge and make its own statement. But it outside of this individual who was part in South Africa during the war, before it was governmentally, institutionalized, I couldn't find anything certain.
No, I haven't found anything either.
Yeah, I've just, on the topic of mourning, I've been thinking about Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial as analogous to the moment of silence in so far as, right, it's a moment where state-authorized forms of memorializing and mourning have lost purchase, right? And then, the sort of bronze statuary of, classical form all of a sudden no longer feels like it has weight. And as a result, the state has to make recourse essentially to minimalism, right? Or to blank form, right? As much as 4:33 in a moment of silence is a kind of blank, empty form. And I think people are picking up on that when they talk, when Jordan and your question brought up the universal quality, is really like the state struggling to find a language for state-authorized mourning. And in that case, the kind of the Charlie Hebdo moment is a really interesting limit case, right? Because though it attempts to be a universalizing moment, is in fact precisely a moment of division within France, where the whole sort of ideology of la cité and the actual divisions that are within that between the sort of the Muslim otherness that has to be excluded from that state model, all of a sudden there's an exclusion in that universality, and all of a sudden it's divisive who decides to observe that particular moment of silence and who doesn't. So I'm wondering, I think there are some very good points that have been made about the kind of the media quality of the moment of silence, that, right, it's enabled by the fact that mass media allows for an act of catastrophe or an act of death to be nationally experienced and nationally witnessed, and then at the same time later nationally observed, which of course requires mass media, it requires radio, it requires clock synchronization and the spread of rapid news. But I'm wondering if there's also this question of a state trying to find a language to mourn, and when the state, when, right, and I say the state rather than the nation, right, a sort of split between a state entity and a kind of entity that's built up in religion and shared culture. What in terms of how the state finds a language for mourning is the moment of silence, kind of like the Vietnam War, and emblematic of a loss of being able to make a recourse to something like, you know, bronze statuary, or as Jordan brought up, the kind of liturgical form.
Well, I mean, this is coming at what you're saying obliquely, but one thing you made me think of is the 9/11 memorial, where, I like it, but it's sort of an action film version of these things, right? Because you're being drowned out. It's so loud. I mean, it's creating, it's silencing, really, I think. It's making a top-down imposition of a kind of silence on people, but by virtue of noise. Certainly, you're right that there's a struggle for language of mourning, and as it's devalued in the case that Matt's brought up, which I think is really haunting in relationship to the plane in the Ukraine, with that idea of what will we do when the bodies keep coming? It's a question that feeds into the media, because obviously we're enveloped in consciousness of local, regional, national, global catastrophe. So if the media didn't force us into a position of perpetual mourning, which no one can inhabit, some of these problems wouldn't manifest. But within that, how we still can select moments that are going to bear the weight of any kind of observance, I think it's actually a frightening question. I don't know. I mean, we smear everything together, right? I mean, I think it's a great question, because it's deeply steeped in questions of how we have decided to exist in a perpetual stream of not just information, but of all sorts of ersatz, communal vocalizations. And within that, interrupting that just raises all sorts of questions that weren't around at the time of the armistice. Although I think, Richard, your point that really does correlate with a moment when the media is starting to rise is important. And it also, I was thinking, it's not so far off from when we have the first organized organized movements to stop noise, to work against the din of the city. You know, they were in New York. I mean, New York and England, but New York had more momentum, and it was not so much earlier. It's the same time when we become conscious of noise, we begin instituting silence. It almost seems.
No, I think it's important note there on the ritualization of this event and how we use it instrumental, and how we're now risking to lose that tool, because I think it's a tool, as all our other films has also been looking at how we use rituals, like we did a film about Last Supper, Last Meal, and that's been used on death row, and how we use this sort of empty gesture to give some kind of meaning to a sort of meaningless situation. And this is one of the few things we can do in order to sort of deal with these catastrophes that's happening. But if the catastrophes keep coming, like we're facing right now in the Mediterranean region, where we have one sort of boat catastrophe after another. So what are we going to do? Are we going to have these events? I mean, as with Charlie Hebdo, we had these 4 million people coming out, and we know it's not going to be another terror attack tomorrow. I don't know why you have that feeling. But it's as with 9/11, you don't have a feeling it will happen again. It's not going to happen every day. We have that under control in somehow. But when it comes to these migrants drowning in the Mediterranean, it's like a black hole. And I think everyone is losing grip around how to deal with that situation. And I don't think we have any ritual that we can use in order to deal with that. Very depressing last words. Yeah, Richard.
I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the arbitrary nature of the timing of it, if you think it's...
I mean, on the film, the clips in the film? Or?
No, just if, from your experience of watching Moments of Silence, if the timing is longer for things that have been, that are more grave, mm-hmm. or I just keep thinking of, like, when a comedian takes a joke too far and it becomes silent and then everybody starts laughing again. I'm wondering if a moment of silence sort of takes, you know, a little while to become less self-aware in order for you to really experience the moment of silence.
Actually, one of the challenges or problems with doing the film was that all this news material is already edited, so you will never find the sort of raw footage. One of the few raw files which we found was actually on the White House own webpage containing these shots of 9/11 commemoration. So they are a bit longer, and so they're a bit different. But no, I can't say that I found some differences in length specifically now.
George, you mentioned being on that panel and calling out the person on the front row who is using their iPhone or whatever. But it's interesting that if indeed the moment of silence became institutionalized with media, I mean, it really was radio, and radio is the slippery slope that brought us the iPhone, I mean, the technology. And, you know, I remember in the days when there were more independent radio stations, how they would make a point of actually, DJs would say, all right, I'm not going to talk for a minute because it proves that I don't have to fill the moment with sound, to prove the independence and the freedom of independent radio. And there's something that media implies sound by its very nature.
Yeah.
Right. That's well, true. I mean, the question would be, did we need the minutes of silence before we had the media? I mean, we can flip it the other way too. So that certainly the media. I mean, it's like that great essay by Freud of civilization and its discontents, which has the wonderful litany of technological developments that have allowed distance to be bridged. And then Freud sort of goes through each one and says, ah, but if we had not displaced ourselves in so many different ways, each one of these wouldn't be necessary. And so I think it becomes a bit of a chicken and egg question, but it's a good one. I mean, and I don't have a... you're right that the radio, certainly the idea of the wireless is the beginning of the slippery slope, because it's... I wrote about Stefan Zweig recently, and he has this extraordinary essay about how the wireless creates inescapability and impotence, because he says, I know, you know, he's writing this in 1927, or it might have even been earlier, that he said, I know about a building falling on people in Shanghai before the people a few streets over do, and therefore these buildings are falling on me as well, and I can't get away from constantly being buried in rubble of the collapse of one cultural shelter and one home or another.
I have one final question. You said that the person in South Africa who had instituted this was doing 3 minutes of silence. Is that correct? The original was
He hadn't instituted it in South Africa, but he'd been very impressed by this pause. It was really considered a silent pause, which is a nice and slightly different idea.
Yeah. And it was 3 minutes?
Yes, it was 3 minutes.
I was wondering, are there documents in that early moment when this thing's getting institutionalized about how many minutes is the right amount? I mean, we're talking about economies of attention, and the question is how long you can hold that attention without it becoming ridiculous or somebody breaking out of it and, you know, undermining the whole ritual. So I was wondering, are there discussions that you've seen in the early, in 1918, 1919, about how many minutes people can hold silence? And also, when I was living in England in the 70s, the most impressive part for me was not we had to be school, we had to gather and be silent, but it was actually the fact that trains all over the country would stop, no matter where they were, at 11 a.m. They would just come to a standstill in the middle of the countryside, as would cars. And in fact, in some sense, the control of that larger technology and just all of that seemed like a more profound move in some sense than human beings gathering themselves. And I was wondering if in the early days they're already discussing trains should come to a stop, factories should stop, you know, machines basically should stop too. And this is really what it is. Are there documents that show the back and forth around?
You know, not to my knowledge. I mean, my guess would be that these decisions were made by very few men in very small rooms with very muffled and private rooms.
Because basically it was a letter that he sent, and there was the communication with the king.
That's right, right. Sort of saying this should be done.
This should be done. Just do it.
Were the rooms as small as this and as muffled as this?
There must have been a message going out to everyone.
But I think, you know, actually just also about that 3 minutes, it would be different. I mean, in terms of how do we deal with the fact that all this is going on, well, maybe we should have 3 minutes every day. You know, it's not so much, is it? And what would it be to just have it be a form of mourning? I mean, I remember the talk here about these mass graves and the whole talk about how we commemorate bodies or bones that are all mixed together. And maybe we shouldn't be trying to distinguish between these tragedies anymore. Maybe we would be humanized by taking that 3 minutes and accepting that this loss was not particular to us, our street, our culture, but was the condition.
One last question, if there is one. No? All right. Well, please join me in thanking Mats and George for a fantastic evening. Thank you.